This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Consent has become a powerful word. A significant number of college students have reported sexual abuse on campus, and there have been policies put in place by many schools across the country to combat the problem. But getting those new rules in place was not easy.
It's taken threats and the specter of scandal for universities to finally pay attention to what has been an issue for many, many decades.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about the complicated issue of consent on campus and how some safeguards that were recently put in place may be getting rolled back. We'll also spend an academic minute trying to make sure younger students get proper sex education. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. In 2015, a survey of over two dozen elite colleges found that 23% of respondents reported personal experiences of sexual misconduct on their campuses. That figure has not changed since the 1980s, when people first began collecting data on sexual violence. What has changed is the level of attention that the American public is paying to these statistics. Reports of sexual abuse repeatedly make headlines, and universities are scrambling to address the crisis. According to Donna Freitas, their current strategy is wholly inadequate. She writes about it in her new book, Consent on Campus, a Manifesto. Donna Freitas lectures at universities across the United States on her work with and about college students. She has authored two other books on campus life and has written for publications, including The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times. Freitas is currently a non-resident research associate at the Center for Religion and Society at Notre Dame. She spoke about her new book with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue, who asked about her work on this sensitive topic.
Looking at sex on campus is just at the core of all the research that I've done as an academic, as a professor, as a teacher, and I realized probably around 2011 when the Obama administration released their April letter about Title IX and sexual assault on campus that I had some things to say. And as I began to think about what did I want to say, I thought, oh, this is an impassioned discourse. Like, this is a manifesto. Like, I just felt like I have an argument to make. And usually what I do is I write based on my research. So I go around, I interview students, I listen to what they say, and then I try to lift up that conversation that they illuminate. And usually I'm not opining much about it. But I realized around then that I really had an opinion about how we should be dealing with consent on campus, how we should be educating, how we should be dealing with systemic sexual violence.
You make an interesting point in the book that the numbers of what we have seen over, say, the last three or four decades have not changed dramatically. The coverage of those incidents and the reports have. And universities are working or scrambling to address what is now perceived as a crisis. So what happened in the sense of that becoming more glaring as far as the understanding that this was going on?
Well, a couple of things happened, which is I mentioned that the Obama administration's letter from 2011, it was
correct,
in April 2011, it was called a Dear Colleague letter, and it was about Title IX and how, yes, Title IX had to do with sexual assault and harassment, and schools had to deal with it. And so that letter put universities on notice. And of course, one of the things that happened was suddenly the threat of universities losing federal funding if they did not adequately address and respond to complaints of sexual violence and harassment on campus was put on the table. And the government began to investigate universities for negligence on this issue. That was one of the things that happened that changed everything. And then, of course, because of this new attention on Title IX, there was new media attention about it when universities were being investigated. And that, in turn, empowered students who had made complaints, whose universities were negligent in relation to their complaints. It gave them more attention in the media. And so what we ended up having was Obama sort of turning a light on Title IX's relationship with sexual assault and harassment, and then also all of these scandals that came about because of the ways schools were mishandling this issue or just ignoring it altogether. And for me, I think the real scandal is that it's taken threats to do with money and the fear, the specter of scandal for universities to finally pay attention to what has been an issue for many, many decades.
I want to get to the meat of the book in just a moment, but it seems that this is the perfect time to then ask, as you say, we're putting a light on the subject during the Obama administration. It would seem in recent days and weeks, given what we are told that is coming from the Trump administration and from the office of Secretary DeVos, that they are looking to perhaps turn that light off, at least when it comes to the responsibilities of those in universities and campuses across the country. I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about where we are right now.
Well, I have been waiting and dreading this for, you know, happening, and I've assumed that Betsy DeVos at some point was going to sort of scroll back all of these steps that the Obama administration had taken around this. And so it looks like that is about to happen, that she's going to sort of walk everything back. And, you know, I think one of the biggest things she's about to do, which I think is really worrisome, is she's about to give a provision that says that universities are only responsible for sexual assault and harassment that happens on campus, which would mean that anything happened at an off-campus party or at an off-campus, you know, professor's house or something like that would not be under the university's jurisdiction. And I think that is incredibly concerning. But one of the things I would say is, you know, I think she's more or less going to walk things back to the status quo, which will make it more difficult for people to, you know, accuse someone of sexual assault, because we go back to the sort of he said, she said situation. If no one else is in the room, it's very difficult to prove that anything happened. We're sort of going back to the older model. What I hope, or what I think would be even more scandalous, is that, of course, if universities walked themselves back on this issue too. And so for the last 7 years, as I've traveled around to talk about this issue on different campuses, you know, it was a slow start back in 2011, but universities are making changes. Like, they've made great strides toward dealing with sexual assault and harassment on campus since that first letter. And I think what would be tragic and also egregious and go against everything that universities are supposed to stand for is if universities took this momentum and went backwards. And so my thought is, or my hope is, that just because Betsy DeVos goes back to the status quo doesn't mean that universities have to. In theory, universities are supposed to deal with society's most difficult issues and problems. And systemic sexual violence is a societal and cultural issue. It's a communal issue at universities and beyond. And one would think that because it's a systemic issue, that universities are uniquely equipped to try to deal with it and to challenge it. It is difficult to understand why they wouldn't keep moving forward. But of course, universities are institutions with boards, and they operate much the same as businesses today. You know, what I worry is that the university will default to that side of itself rather than the more sort of lofty, principled force for good, I think, that we often think about universities as.
In the second chapter of your book, you talk about the state of consent education. Let's start there with a definition of what we should consider consent to be and the importance of that education.
What universities are usually teaching is a sort of affirmative consent model, which is, you know, you hear people speak a lot about, like, yes means yes and no means no. And that's sort of like consent at its most basic level. And as we're teaching it, and usually universities are offering that education in a 1 hour or around an hour event at the beginning of the first year of college. And that is often all that is offered to students, except I am more interested in not just the how of consent. So you could see the yes means yes, no means no as the literal how of consent, but the why of it. You know, why should we care? What does it mean to consent? And, you know, I think consent has to do with ethics. You know, it's an ethical attitude toward a partner. And so I think it is much more layered than just the surface yes means yes and no means no. And I think when you teach it as just words, it becomes an objective. Like, I got to get this from my partner so I don't get in trouble, as opposed to, why is it that it's important for me to make sure that my partner wants to be there? I think one of the things that we're doing at universities is we're dispensing information. We're making sure that people got the literal, I was calling it technical consent in the book. We make sure that they understand technical consent, but we're not necessarily, you know, empowering them to have the conversations they need to think about, well, why do we care about consent at all? What does it mean? Like, why is it important? What does it have to do with sexual violence? What does it have to do with respect for my partner?
And then you bring in the book, and of course, it makes sense at this point to bring in alcohol and drugs into the equation. So in many of the policies, they say someone who is under the influence of alcohol, drugs, or other intoxicants may be incapacitated and therefore unable to consent. So what does that mean for both parties?
Part of where this is coming from, of course, is that binge drinking is an issue on campus. And we have had, very tragically and sadly, many instances where a student has been passed out at a party and someone has had sex with that person. And so they have, you know, been sexually assaulted. It saddens me that we're in a place where we have to make sure students know that if a student is passed out, you should not have sex with them. So, I mean, that is part of where that is coming from. But it's also this issue of, you know, there are students who black out when they're drinking and then they don't necessarily know what's happening. And so alcohol can be a very problematic issue with regard to consent. So one of the things that I think is complicated about how we're dealing with this on campus, though, with our policies, is that, one, there's sort of concern that we're blaming the drinking, so that we're somehow, because students drink, people get sexually assaulted, as opposed to the idea that people are the ones who do the sexual assaulting, not, you know, not the alcohol. The alcohol may be a factor, but ultimately, not drinking is not a preventative measure for sexual assault. So there's that issue, but also, one of the things that's been happening is universities are putting alcohol into their consent policies. And often it's very vague, of course, because you can't necessarily say once someone has been drinking, you know, two beers, then they can't consent. Right. It's not that specific. And so I've been in many conversations with students in the last few years who ask questions like, oh, well, so does that mean if I had sex when I was drinking that it was sexual assault? And so we've begun to associate drinking with sexual assault rather than having a broader conversation with students about how drinking can affect your ability to make decisions and why do you binge drink in the first place, like having a broader conversation about drinking. And instead, we're just sort of throwing in these policies that are very vague and that don't necessarily ask students to reflect on drinking. And I've been in conversations with students in the last couple of years where I've said, you know, you can drink and have sex and it's not sexual assault. It just depends on the circumstance. And because it's vague, though, that really stresses them out.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with Donna Freitas continues with a look at hookup culture on campus. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Donna Freitas, and she's talking with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue about her new book, Consent on Campus, A Manifesto. While talking about sexual assault, Joe brought up the topic of hookup culture on campus.
Well, I want to say first off that a hookup is not, by definition, a sexual assault by any means. Hookups can be many things. They can be sexual assaults, but they're certainly not always. I think what generally students understand hookups as, you know, it's a it's some form of sexual intimacy. It can be anything from kissing to various kinds of sexual intercourse. So there's some form of sexual intimacy. It's brief. And in theory, it happens once, but, you know, it may happen multiple times, you know, over the course of however long between two students. But then the third criteria is they're not supposed to get attached. In fact, they're supposed to be apathetic about the sexual intimacy itself and about their partner. So you're supposed to be able to walk away not caring about that person. And, you know, in theory, hookups are supposed to be these very empowering sexual encounters where students are able to sort of be with whoever they want and have this very exciting experience and then have it just be temporary or momentary. That would be great, I think, if students experienced them that way. But in reality, you know, hookups generally happen in a culture of hooking up. And in a culture of hooking up, you have these norms that are handed down to students. And, you know, one of those norms is that you're not supposed to care about your partner, and, you know, you're not supposed to be attached to them, and sex is supposed to be kind of meaningless. It's supposed to be casual in a very literal sense. And I think what's problematic for hookups, when we're thinking about a culture of hooking up and those norms I just described, and then consent, which asks a person to check in with their partner, to care about them, to consider them in the context of, you know, sexual intimacy, I think that it presents a paradox. And so I think a culture of hooking up, so not just individual hookups, but a culture of hooking up perpetuates or feeds right into this idea we have of rape culture, which is, you know, where we talk about rape culture is systemic sexual violence. It's the circumstances or the conditions in which sexual violence can flourish. And I do think that if the norms within a culture of hooking up include not caring about your partner, you know, disregarding your partner, apathy toward your partner, considering sex as a meaningless act, then I think that presents a real problem for consent, because I think consent asks the opposite.
You write in a chapter of the book called A Hierarchy of Bodies, you write about women are socialized to blame and to doubt. And you write, there is yet another type of shame and blame that disempowers women, the shame and blame we learn to direct at ourselves. Girls and women are socialized to monitor their own behavior and be aware of how it might invite the wrong kind of attention. How do we change that?
Well, I mean, I would say that the question is how do we change, you know, the way girls and women are socialized to blame themselves, to doubt themselves, and then also, how do we change the way boys and men are socialized in our culture to understand their own relationship to sex and to women if they are heterosexual? And so, you know, I think one of the things we need to do is just backing up from there is we need to do a lot of work as a culture in terms of sex education. You know, we don't necessarily raise our children to be empowered sexual beings. We don't raise them to ask big questions about who they are in relation to sex. What does sex mean to them? What do they want from it? You know, I think there's a kind of lack of sexual self-possession or sexual self-awareness, if you will, you know, among both men and women. And of course, this really creates problems and insecurities when young men and women become high school students and then college students. And so I think we need to back up and ask questions about all genders and what is going on that, you know, we're raising our kids to not be empowered around these issues, to not have confidence with regard to themselves, but also their decision-making around sex.
So to wrap up, I mean, you write this book as a call to action for universities and faculty and parents and students to create cultures of consent on their campuses, and you write about what can be done. So as we conclude, where do you think we are in that, and where does your optimism lie in those points being made on campuses?
Well, I would say we're really close and we're also really far. What I'm proposing in the book is real practical advice on, okay, if we are going to try to tackle systemic sexual violence, how can we do it? And I think it needs to happen in the classroom. There is no way that we can tackle this issue, a systemic societal issue, with a one-hour, you know, event at the beginning of freshman year and then maybe like a human resources like tutorial that everybody's got to take on campus. Like, that's not where you deal with systemic issues. I think you need to move the conversation into the classroom. Of course, we have all the resources to do that, right? You know, universities are full of classrooms. And universities are full of brilliant minds who are specifically, you know, thinking about systemic issues and how to tackle them. And so I would say we're close in the sense that I think universities already have all the resources they need to begin to tackle this problem and to try to transform it. But I think the hurdle is, of course, you have to get people on board and thinking about consent more broadly, about sex education in a much bigger picture way. And part of the problem is that we don't necessarily think about consent and sex ed as something that should happen in the university classroom. So I think we're very close in the sense that we have all the resources and the people we need already. But I think we're far in the sense that we haven't begun to even think about consent education in this deeper, broader way.
Again, the name of Donna Freitas' new book is Consent on Campus, A Manifesto. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Some people say before we can teach about consent, we need to ensure students are giving basic sex education. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How do we ensure students get sexual education? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Rachel Robinson, associate professor at the School of International Service at American University, explores how two different communities did just that.
Parents, educators, and policymakers the world over worry that teaching teenagers about contraception will make them more likely to begin having sex earlier than they might otherwise. Spoiler alert, it doesn't, not in the United States and not in Africa. But those fears of triggering precocious sexual behavior are difficult to dispel, despite the proven value of sexuality education in making teens healthier. Given these fears, it is surprising that Mississippi and Nigeria have come to require schools to offer sex ed. Why compare a mid-sized state with the so-called giant of Africa? Until recently, only half of states in the U.S. mandated sex ed, while Nigeria, like many other low-income countries, lacked such programs entirely. Mississippi is among the U.S. states with the highest teen pregnancy rates, while in Nigeria, almost a quarter of women have begun childbearing by age 19. Mississippi and Nigeria are also highly religious and rural, with underfunded education and health systems. Thus, it was somewhat unexpected when Nigeria mandated the teaching of sex ed in 2001, and Mississippi followed suit a decade later. The research my colleagues and I conducted looked at the elements that helped to overcome controversies around sex ed in the two areas. First, homegrown organizations lobbied, linked people together, and provided legitimacy to ideas that otherwise might have seemed foreign. Crucially, these organizations were supported by outside funding. Second, to promote sex ed, these organizations and the people working for them described it as a solution to social problems— the taxpayer cost of teen pregnancy in Mississippi, and the HIV/AIDS epidemic in Nigeria. Third, they also used context-specific strategies, including highlighting parts of the curriculum that focused on overall health rather than sex. While there is no universal pathway to ensuring access to sex ed, our research shows that the commonalities between Mississippi and Nigeria's experiences can be applied in other U.S. states and developing countries.
That was Rachel Robinson of American University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.